Hey guys, this is John Karabi from the Dead Daisies and, well, pretty much every band but ABBA, and you are listening to The Vinyl Guide. Turn it up.
This episode is brought to you by Vintage Media Grading at vmgvinyl.com. Explore how professional grading can protect your records at vmgvinyl.com.
And now, on with the show.
Well, hey there, boys and girls. Welcome to episode 411 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And this week we welcome John Karabi of the Dead Daisies, formerly of Motley Crue, Rat, and about a dozen other bands you know and love. Today, John discusses his return to the Dead Daisies, the new best of LP from the band, what it's like in this dream gig of the Dead Daisies, what's next for them. Plus, we discuss John's history on vinyl records, the collectability of his catalog, his recent autobiography, Horseshoes and Hand Grenades, some harrowing moments of his life, including auditioning for Quiet Riot, moments with Nirvana, hanging out with Eddie Van Halen at 5150 Studios, and much more. Now, just in case you don't know, the Dead Daisies have a new best of album, has not only some of their most beloved tracks, but a few newbies on vinyl as well. So there you go. Shake down your local record shop for a copy of the new Best of the Dead Daisies on vinyl. It's an absolutely gorgeous package with two LPs, full color poster, booklet, gatefold sleeve, and more. And of course, you want to follow the Dead Daisies on social media so you know when they're in your town and you could lock up the liquor cabinet accordingly. And finally, if you enjoy the Dead Daisies and rock and roll interviews, make sure you follow this podcast in your podcast app. You are just one click away from enjoying interviews with the likes of Perry Farrell and Eric Avery of Jane's Addiction, episode 387, Chris Shiflett of Foo Fighters, episode 382, Gavin Rossdale of Bush, episode 361, Doug Aldrich of the Dead Daisies, episode 358, Kenny Jones of The Who, The Faces, and The Small Faces, episode 339, Eric Kretz of Stone Temple Pilots, episode 328, and literally hundreds more. Follow The Vinyl Guide in your favorite podcast app. It's all there at your fingertips and ear holes. So with the upfronts done, let's get into The Vinyl Guide interview with Mr. John Karabi.
Hey, buddy.
Mr. Karabi, how are you, mate?
I'm all right. How are you?
Good, good, good. Greetings from Australia. And congrats on the return to the Dead Daisies, as well as this Greatest Hits album.
Yes, it's. I'm looking forward to all of it. I think the it's going to be a lot of fun getting back on stage with the guys and the record. I'm actually really excited for the record for a few reasons. Obviously, I get some more music out there, but you know, it's funny, if I can use my wife as an example, she heard the record and she was not familiar with John Stevens or Glenn Hughes. And after hearing everything, she was like, wow, these other guys are, they're great singers, songwriters. And I think that's going to be the cool thing about this record. It is a 10-year marker for us to, you know, this is what we've done so far. And, you know, more to come in the future. But I think for people, like, if they were attached to one singer and got involved with the Daisies, it maybe will turn them on to the other two guys. You know what I mean? Whoever their favorite was, it'll turn them on to the other two singers. So I'm looking forward to that. I think that's just, it's just awesome. Now my wife is a, you know, huge John Stevens fan and a Glenn Hughes fan as well. So it's gonna be cool.
Now, understanding the Dead Daisies is, you know, sometimes a rotating cast of characters, right? What is the conversation or relationship like with former members? For example, you and Glenn kind of went back many years, so I'm assuming you guys still communicate very well. It's not weird. You guys have a group chat or something?
No, even the whole time Glenn was in the band, Glenn and I communicated all the time through Instagram, Facebook, you know, send each other messages. It's not like we call each other, or, you know, when I'm in LA, I'll go to have dinner at his house or anything like that. But we've always remained friends. You know, I call him Brother Glenn, and he, you know, so whatever. Like, I would comment on something. Hey, have fun on the tour. And, you know, like when I posted my dates, I just finished a run. Well, I finished tomorrow with a huge tour I did with Tom Kiefer and Winger here in the States. So when I was posting all the dates on there, Glenn wrote to me and he's like, go get him, kid. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So we, you know, I'm still really good with Marco, Dizzy, Richard. And even when I wasn't in the band, I didn't leave on bad terms. So there was one point where they were getting ready to tour with Glenn and he wasn't feeling well. So I flew up to New York and just kind of rehearsed with them and helped get them musically prepared for their rehearsals with Glenn. So it's all good, dude. Everything's been, you know, when I was in the band, it was awesome. When I left the band, it was awesome. Now I'm back in the band and it's awesome again. You know what I mean? So it is what it is.
It seems to me, an outsider, of course, the Dead Daisies is a dream gig. I mean, it yeah. must be. I mean, is it the best gig in rock and roll? It must be. Yeah.
You know, it's funny. Like, obviously, you know, David's history. Yeah, it's, you know what? It's cool because David takes care of all of us really well, and he's assembled great players. But the coolest part is that we're all friends. So it's like, yeah, he takes care of us. There's great players. We have a great chemistry together, and we're friends. You know, so it's kind of, yeah, for lack of a better term, it's kind of a dream gig because, and then when I'm not working with them, I can still go out and do my own thing and release music and go tour and do shows. And, you know, so, I mean, there isn't really a, other than my personal reasons for leaving the first time, there's really no downside to this whole thing. You know what I mean?
Why did you leave the first time? Was that you just needed a break? What was the background?
It's very simple. You know, like most people would look at me and go, dude, are you effing crazy? Like the band was like really picking up a ton of momentum. But from a personal standpoint, I had been in a solo band prior to joining the Daisies with my son. My son moved from LA to Nashville to be in my solo band.
This is Ian.
Yes.
Okay.
And I think maybe 3 or 4 months before I started working with the Daisies, I had just gotten married to my wife. So between those two things, I had my son in one ear going, Dad, you suck. You joined the Dead Daisies. Now I don't even see you, let alone do any gigs. You know, so that was in one ear. And then the other was, you know, I think in the 4 years I was in the band, I think maybe if you took all the time that we were off, I think it was home maybe 3 or 4 months. So I kind of felt like I said, I do to my wife and then see you in 4 years. You know what I mean? Kind of a deal. So it was just getting taxing. We were all burnt by the end of 2018. I don't care what anybody says. Everybody in the band was burnt. Management was burnt. The crew was burnt. And then I had these other things in my ears, you know, at home. And I just said, you know what? I think I'm going to take some time here to myself. I'm just going to go do some solo shows with my kid and, you know, kind of work at my own pace for a minute. Obviously, nobody saw COVID coming. That really changed everything for everybody. You know, and I did some really positive stuff. I wrote a book. I did release some music. I took Pro Tools classes during COVID to learn how to record myself, because when it shut down, it shut down. You weren't doing gigs. You weren't in the studio with other people. And I just did not like the pretty much, for lack of a better term, the helpless feeling of relying on others. So I took Pro Tools classes. I kind of learned how to do my own thing. I'm still kind of caveman with it. I'm slow, but at least I'm moving forward. And, you know, so I took some time off, and now David called me and said, Glenn's going back to do his Deep Purple stuff. Are you rested? And I go, yeah, I'm feeling pretty good. So we talked, and then he assured me that we were going to get back into the swing of things. We were going to go on tour. There was a new record coming out. There's going to be new music in the future, but not to the point of burnout for anybody.
Okay. He was feeling it too, it sounds like.
Yeah, he was feeling it. We all were. And, you know, David said the one thing when he first started putting this together, the idea was to go out, do some kick-ass music, go do some great shows, but have fun. And we were kind of losing sight of the fun part. So he's like, I just want to go out and have some fun and enjoy myself and just play rock and roll and kick ass. So here we are.
And it sounds like David's a pretty understanding dude when you needed a break or you have side projects. I mean, you can balance Dead Daisies with some of your acoustic stuff at the same time. Yeah.
Yes. And that's the thing. I said to David, like, I have a manager and then we have a manager with the Dead Daisies. And I said, you know what? There's no reason why I can't do both. As long as my manager and their manager are communicating with each other in advance, I know, like, I don't want to release music at the same time the Daisies are going to release music. That's counterproductive. I don't want to book shows with the Daisies or solo and then have to postpone or cancel things. So I said, as long as that's on the table and there's communication there, everything will be fine.
Okay. So during breaks of the Dead Daisies, it's very likely you can be out on the road with a few acoustic gigs or something else.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and as well, like I said to David, you know, I've got a little home studio now. I'll write music. Dead Daisies will have first option, and anything the Daisies don't want to do, I'll just stockpile it and I'll release it myself later. No big deal.
And I want to talk to you about vinyl, because our podcast is about vinyl, and I know you got a big history with vinyl. I've been reading the book Horseshoes and Hand Grenades. I'm almost to the end. I hope the main character survives. But I've noticed
barely. That's
I've noticed you got some upcoming shows, and in those shows are several dates in Japan. And I was very interested to see that you're allowed back in that country after some of your previous tours.
You know what? I'm actually quite surprised as well myself. So, but they haven't quite put the face to the name yet. So I'm just gonna
keep the beard. Yeah.
Yeah.
So growing up with records, now in your book, you detail quite a bit about the records that inspired you, the music that made you you. Do you still listen to records? Do you still have a record collection?
No, you know, I'm building, oddly enough, I've been buying vinyl records again. I still haven't found a turntable that I really care for. I bought a couple and I took them back. I just didn't like the way they sounded. There was just something about them that I didn't really care for. So I'm looking for, like, you know, the perfect kind of tabletop, nice speakers, whatever, record player. But oddly enough, I'm buying the records that I already had 30 years ago. I'm like rebuying catalogs again. And I'm like, I could kick myself in the ass for having gotten rid of my vinyl collection when Hollywood Records handed me the first, the Scream CD. And I was like, CDs? Are we not doing records? They're like, nah, vinyl. It's old news. So I got rid of my record collection. And now I'm kind of, I find myself buying like Sabbath, Masters of Reality, and Grand Funk Were an American Band, and Caught in the Act, and the entire Beatles catalog again, and Queen. And, you know, so I'm like, you know, I'm just buying it, whatever. I've got most of the records that I've done on vinyl. So I've got all those. And I'm just, again, I'm just buying the stuff that I had 30 years ago. You know what I mean?
Right.
But isn't that what we're all doing? Like, you know, I was just sitting here pricing. The first car that I ever had was a 1977 Chevy Nova Super Sport. And I bought it for $4,300 brand new.
That was the one Uncle Gene helped finance.
Yeah. And I'm literally looking at them now, and they're like, you know, anywhere between $40,000 and $50,000. So I'm just sitting there like, wow. Yeah, that was a smart move. So, you know, I should have just put all my vinyl, all my vintage, like original Kiss belt buckles, and all my vintage concert t-shirts in the car and just sold them, you know, whatever. And I would still feel the same shitty way as I do right now. It's, you know, whatever. So that's what we do. We have stuff, we get rid of it. And then later we go, man, what was I thinking?
So you're buying records, but you don't have a turntable yet. So you must have a plan of some sort.
No, I do. I do. I bought a couple of them, and I literally brought them home, unboxed them, put a record on, and I'm like, this thing sounds like ass. So I just, where'd you go? Oh, there you are. I buy a record player, bring it home, and put a record on it. And it was like, you know, the needle would skip across, and I'm like, oh, take it back. Then I'd get something else, and it's like, no, this one sounds like shit. So I just haven't found the, I know what's going to happen. I'm going to wind up spending like $3,000-$4,000 on like some really killer turntable system, whatever. But I don't know.
You know what it sounds like, John? It sounds like you need the turntable set up properly. Because there is a bit of an art to making sure the needle just rests in that groove without having too much weight down or not enough weight on.
And it's weird. I bought one from, it was weird. It was Guitar Center, and they had a audio whatever. And I bought this record player, and I brought it home, and it had external speakers, and I plugged it in, and I put on Grand Funk Were an American Band album. Mm-hmm. And popped it in there, and the song started playing, and then it just started skipping like every other word. And I go, all right, lift. I'm looking at it, checking the needle, put it back on, nothing. Tried a different record, did the same thing. I go right back in the box, right back to Guitar Center. So whatever. I'll find the right one.
Yeah. You may want to have someone to set it up too, because it's almost like a guitar, you know. You got to make sure the action is right and whatever, and having that sort of balance. So that may help you get closer to having a record player that you enjoy. Now, most of your solo stuff is on vinyl. And by the way, there's a lot of very collectible John Corabi vinyl. I'm not sure if you're aware of some of these, but there's a lot of records you're on that are highly collectible and go for several hundred dollars.
Well, I didn't know that, but I saw, like, Kat told me that we were going to do an interview, and she said, oh, some of the questions he's going to ask her about your vinyl collection and what rare records do you listen to? And I go, well, that's easy. Anything I sang on is rare.
Yeah, well, look, there's I think you've done well with some of the limited editions. I know the one night in Nashville There's one like a tan and black splatter. I mean, that one goes for $100-$150. There's the John Corabi Unplugged. There's a white vinyl version. That one goes for quite a lot. The Motley record, it hasn't been reissued. So the originals, they go for $400-$500.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, somebody just asked me, I was doing a show and they go, hey, man, are you ever going to release the Motley stuff on vinyl? And I go, that's a Motley question. But I can pretty much tell you that the answer is going to be no. Because, you know, they're burying that time, that 5 years. That 5 years did not happen in their lives. But again, that's like, if you look at the Scream album, the Union stuff, the Motley, you know, it's like you can't find it anywhere.
A lot of those records, like Brides of Destruction, that's another one that's highly collectible. So yeah, a lot of the stuff that you're on is quite rare. So have you kept copies of those over the years at all?
I don't have the Brides of Destruction. I have the Scream, the Union stuff, and I believe I have one copy of the Motley record on vinyl. I believe. I could be wrong.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But,
yeah. Funny because I didn't save it, but my ex-wife, Valerie, Ian's mother, just sent me a box with stuff in it. And I was like, I'm like, oh my God, here's an original, you know, Scream cassette. Here's like the long, remember the old long box CDs? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I had an unopened Scream CD from like 1991. And then there was a couple of vinyls there that had the little metal patch on it. And then between what she had and what my managers got, it's available. I could either get a copy or just borrow it once in a while.
Right. Are you a bit of a romantic, kind of looking back? I know you just wrote the book, which I mean is a quite a big effort. And your memory for years and years ago and activities that happened is quite extraordinary. Going into a lot of detail about things that happened and what I'm assuming is a pretty fuzzy time of your life with everything that's going on. Do you look back a lot at that sort of thing, or are you pretty much constantly looking forward?
No, I try to look forward. It was a bit of a task, and that's why I put a disclaimer in the beginning of the book, and I said, this is my recollections, you know, to the best of my ability. You know, and it's funny, we were sitting around talking with Tom Kiefer and his band guys, and I was telling them other stories, and they're like, dude, I hope that's in the book. And I go, I don't know if that's in the book or not, but, you know, it's just funny, stupid things that I've done, or, you know, girls I dated, or just whatever, some crazy thing that happened with a band. And I tried to, you know, Paul Miles tried to help me, the best he could. And he did a ton of research. So I'll give him that. He's like the king of that shit. But he would ask me a question that would just lead off into another story. So I just kind of told him something that was in reference to the question asked. You know, there's definitely a bunch of other observations and dumb things that I've done that I forgot about, but it was actually fun doing that book. It did, on occasion, reading about, you know, the Uncle Jack stuff and some divorces and different things. I did get a little bit of a stomach ache and had to go make myself a cup of tea or whatever, but then just, you know, come back, read it. So it was fun. It was therapeutic. It was all of the above, whatever. Mm-hmm.
Did you get any blowback from the book? You're very honest, and you revealed a lot, not only about yourself, but things that were going around, people around there. I mean, did you get anyone saying, God, I wish you didn't put that in the book?
Well, I have not said a word to my second ex-wife since our divorce. So there could be some there, but no, I mean, obviously I wanted to make sure with my brothers and sisters, you know, me talking about in depth the Uncle Jack stuff. But they were like, nah, dude, have at it. Go for it. You know, whatever. So far, so good. I'll knock on wood. But
I'll knock on wood for you.
I haven't heard anybody really. One person said that I had a story wrong. It was a gentleman named Larry Mazur that used to manage Cinderella, Britney Fox, and he said that I was incorrect in some of the stories. But I'll still argue with him that I don't think that I was wrong. But it's all good.
Yeah. Now there are a few stories I just want to touch on, if that's all right. One of them, it was almost mentioned in passing that you had either auditioned or been offered to audition for Quiet Riot back in the day.
Yes. I think they had just done Quiet Riot 3. And I can't really, if memory serves me correctly, I had known Eric Singer. I had met Eric Singer. My wife used to work at a hair salon. Eric used to come in all the time. And she had played him, like, some of my music. And I'd met him a few times. So he ran into Frankie Benali. And Frankie had told him that Kevin had either quit or got fired or whatever his deal was. And they were looking for a singer. So Eric Singer goes, well, I know this kid, you know, he just moved to town. His wife works at, you know, this hair place called Joey's Hair Fantasy on Sunset Boulevard. And he said, I've heard his stuff. He's pretty good. So Frankie called me and I went into the recording studio with them and I had to sing The Wild and the Young. I think that was the song from Quiet Riot 3. And I was nervous. I was, you know, like I'm just in LA. You know, you got to remember Quiet Riot was still kind of a headlining act at the time. And like I'd seen all their videos and, you know, all this stuff. And all of a sudden I'm in this studio auditioning for them. So in their behalf, in their defense, I truly sounded like someone was skinning a cat alive. And they, you know, they passed on me, which was fine. Everything worked out the way it's supposed to. But yeah, I was just some like snot-nosed kid from Philadelphia all of a sudden getting offered, you know, an audition with Quiet Riot. Like this band was headlining arenas at the time, you know what I mean? And yeah. I was kind of freaking out about it. So I didn't do it wasn't my finest hour auditioning.
Or half hour.
Or 50 minutes.
Another name that comes up in your book is Kurt Cobain. You had a few moments with Kurt, and one of them was a few months before he passed.
We'll be back after these messages.
There's no doubt about it. Record collecting has become a serious hobby and even an investment for many around the world. So record collectors have to ask themselves how best to protect their prized records and confidently buy and sell with others. There is an option to consider. Vintage media grading at vmgvinyl.com. vmgvinyl.com will professionally grade your record and encase it in protective plastic, so your record will retain its value for decades to come. This is the same approach that comic book and sports card collectors have done for years. Now, I know many record collectors will be horrified with the thought of having their records graded and encased in plastic. And for the majority of records, this isn't necessary. But if you have top dollar records that you need to protect, maybe a super rare album that's languishing on the shelf, a one-off misprint, or a special LP that you want to protect, look up vmgvinyl.com, Vintage Media Grading, and see if this service is right for you. That's Vintage Media Grading, vmgvinyl.com.
Hey everyone, I'm here to talk to you about Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Ever find a record in a used bin where the vinyl is gorgeous, but the sleeve has this
ugly split and is even falling completely apart. Well, that's okay. Grab it anyway, because with Seems Easy Record Sleeve Repair Strips, you can fix that right up.
Seems Easy Record Repair Strips repair seam splits from the inside,
so it doesn't affect the appearance of a record sleeve, but it does make it functional again. With Seems Easy, records can now slide in and out like new.
Turn a $5 record into a $25 functioning collectible.
Just ask your local record shop for Seems Easy strips, and if they're not in stock, go to SeemsEasy.com. That's Seems Easy with two Z's. Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Seems easy because it is. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE. 10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits.
Another name that comes up in your book is Kurt Cobain. You had a few moments with Kurt, and one of them was a few months before he passed. Yeah?
I can't really say that I had a moment with him. It was more with Dave Grohl.
Mm-hmm.
Kurt was there. He wasn't present, if you know what I mean. And Tommy and I just happened to walk out. We were in Paris. I remember there was a snowstorm. We stayed at this place called the St. James Hotel. And Tommy just called me and said, "Hey, dude, you want to take a walk down?" We were like right around the corner from the Eiffel Tower. And it was snowing. So we're like, "Oh, yeah, let's go." So we walked down the street and around the corner, and I can't remember the name of that main street there where the Eiffel Tower is, but we were standing there and somebody yelled, "Yo, Tommy." And we turned around and it was Dave Grohl, and he came running up to Tommy and they started chit chatting, and we sat down for a second. We had a little coffee, and it was just like, you know,
Kurt was not into socializing.
No, not at all. And just, I don't know what he was on, but he just seemed like he was on something and just not real, not present at all. But Dave was awesome. You know, we're talking to him and Tommy was bullshitting with him. And we sat there for a minute and then we got up and kind of went about our business. But and then I saw them in England with the screen right when Nevermind came out, or right before it came out. They did two sold out shows in this tiny, I can't even remember the name of the club, tiny little dingy club that we all went to with the record label, and just destroyed that place. It was awesome.
So much is made out of how when Nirvana came on the scene that the music industry changed almost overnight. Do you remember that moment or indications that a change had happened?
No, you know what though? I don't really blame Nirvana for that at all. I blame just the industry in itself. Something needed to happen anyway, because there was, you know, there was the Originators, the Bon Jovis, the Def Leppards, there was the Motley Crues, and then there was all the sub, same genre, or Guns N' Roses, and Poison. I'll count them as one of the Originators. And then there was all the, you know, copy understudies. But that's historically the way the record labels operate. You know, I mean, if you think about the Beatles came to America, they started doing all this stuff. And then all of a sudden it was like, the Beatles, the Kinks, the Stones, the Who. Like, you know, it's just the market gets flooded with these bands and it gets shoved down everybody's throat to the point of, okay, I'm over this. And the bands that kind of grow and change and evolve are the ones that rise to the top and or the originators. You know, and it was the same in the 80s. When you look at the bands, like I said, the Bon Jovis, the, you know, Def Leppard, Motley Crue, Guns N' Roses, Poison, and then all of the other bands that came along that were like dressing like Poison or dressing like Motley Crue or dressing, trying to sound that like them, emulate them. There was hundreds of copycat bands. And all Nirvana did was get rid of all the copycat bands. All the originators kind of backed up a little bit. And then they just waited, you know, till they were fashionable again. They came back out. Motley, Bon Jovi, Def Leppard, Guns N' Roses, you know, they rose to the top again. Cream always rises to the top. And all the other ones fell by the wayside. So it needed to happen.
But you never know when those sort of seismic events are going to happen. So right. When it did, what was the indication to you that there was a shift?
Well, you know, it's funny. I just did a docuseries on Paramount Plus called I Want to Rock. I don't know when it's going to be outside of the United States, but it's been running for like a month now. And Ricky Rackman said something that was really interesting in the docuseries, where he said, anybody that tells you, you know, he calls it the G for grunge. He goes, anybody tells you the G for grunge is what ruined rock and roll? He goes, I'm going to tell them they're full of shit. Because the guy that sold more records than everybody almost combined was Garth Brooks around that same time. That country, you know, Garth Brooks did 5 records in a row, and I think he sold like 100 million records, 5 records. And he goes, so if anything, country music started to like stick its foot in the door and go, hold on a minute. We haven't been heard from yet. So it was just a weird time. Like everything was changing. Country was coming up. The Seattle scene was coming up. But it, I mean, even look at that now, like you look at all the bands, you know, that Seattle scene. And most of them are like, other than Alice in Chains, who's around anymore? Do you know what I mean? It's,
yeah.
That's the thing that I'm talking about. The industry eats itself. You know what I mean? They just flood the market with a ton of bands that all sound the same. And then people get tired of it like that. And they move on to something else. It was funny. A couple, I don't know. I'm sorry I'm rambling, but you opened this can. it's funny. I guess it was probably 8 years ago. Even Nickelback, like I don't have an issue with Nickelback. I think they've got some really great songs. But it was funny, there was a period there where I would turn a radio on in my car or whatever, and I would go, oh, is this Nickelback? No, that's this band. Oh, next song would come on. Oh, is this Nickelback? No, that's this other band. So there was even a period there where like everybody sounded like Nickelback. And now look, they're all gone. It was like, boom, they sold a gazillion records. And now it's like, who cares? You know what I mean? It's just weird. This is why I think it'll never be repeated again. The greatest 15 years of music, hands down, I dare anybody to argue with me on this, is from when the Beatles did Rubber Soul to 1980. Mm. After that, I could take it or leave it. And the reason I say this is because I grew up in a time in an era when rock music was rock. It was rock music was everything from Led Zeppelin to Joan Baez or Jim Croce or James Taylor and everything in between. Carlos Santana, that was rock.
Even Stevie Wonder.
Stevie Wonder, yeah, Superstitious. That was kind of rock. That'd be on some rock stations. You had Leonard Skinner. You had Black Sabbath. You had Yes or Jethro Tull, prog bands, you know, and then somebody like Paul Simon, Billy Joel, you know. So it's funny. Again, I'm sorry for rambling. I just saw these playlists on Spotify. And I just turned my wife on to them, who, again, is a little younger than I am. And they have a series on Spotify called The Best of Rock and then a year. So it's like 1970, 71, 72, 73, whatever. And I literally downloaded all of them, put them in my library. And I was sitting here with my wife. And I go, I want you to just listen to something. I'm going to play you 1 year. Playlist. So she was born in 72. So I played her the 72 playlist. And I said, now think about what I'm about to say. Like, every one of these amazingly successful classic songs were all created and released in the same year. Like Ziggy Stardust. You got like all this. All these amazing songs, and it was just mind-boggling. But even within that list, you had Steely Dan, you had the Doobie Brothers, you had Joni Mitchell, like all these, and it was just rock music, rock. There was no categories, there was no like, it wasn't like, oh well, I'm just into acoustic stuff. That's what we did. We would go see Sabbath on Monday, go see Queen on Tuesday, go see Yes on Wednesday, go see Jim Croce on Thursday, go see Foghat on Friday. You know what I mean? It was just a different time when record labels actually developed bands and allowed them to truly do what they wanted. Not, they didn't have to follow a blueprint of the other guy that was successful.
Yeah, in talking with Chuck D, he said the same thing about radio. Like, he would listen to soul stations that would also play rock. So his exposure was from, like you say, Foghat to Stevie Wonder, to from Marvin Gaye to Led Zeppelin to Bad Company. I mean, that was all in their wheelhouse as well.
Yeah, it shows on, like, every Friday night. There was every Friday night at midnight was a TV show hosted by Wolfman Jack called The Midnight Special.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And they played everything. They played everything from, they would play the Raspberries. They would play, you know, Alex Harvey. They would play Stevie Wonder or the Ohio Players or, you know what I mean? And it was the same the next day. I remember clearly seeing Aerosmith, Kansas, the Ohio Players, Earth, Wind, and Fire on a TV show called Don Kirshner's Rock Concert. So we had all these avenues and all these things to be turned on to. Dude, I went to go see Earth, Wind, and Fire at the Spectrum in Philadelphia. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I look around the audience and you would think it would be, you know, all African-American people, but it was very mixed. You know what I mean? It wasn't that unusual to go see whatever, Taj Mahal or Buddy Miles. And it's just Rory Gallagher. You know what I mean? Just, it was music. And that's what I miss it. And I said that 15 years of eclectic, brilliant, original music will never happen again, ever.
They wholeheartedly agree. And the good news is you were able to live through it and take advantage of quite a bit of it as well. Out of all the times to be a human on Earth, you got to live in the golden age.
Yes. And I also know what a quaalude is. Whatever. Talk about that another time.
All right. So a couple more things. Speaking of it'll never happen again, Eddie Van Halen. You had some time with Eddie. Talk to us about that, because I think you'd had a few interactions, one of which was the infamous backyard party. Yeah.
Yes. That guy was, to me, truly the Howard Hughes of music. Like, you know, it's like you see that movie, The Aviator, and Howard Hughes is walking around in his apartment with Kleenex boxes on his feet, naked, you know, urinating in milk jugs. But then he has this brilliant thought, like, I know what, I think we can get the plane to go faster if we sand down the rivets so that they're smooth. There's no drag on the plane. And not that Eddie was walking around with Kleenex boxes on his feet, but he had his quirks, dude. And he was like, it was just weird. Like, he would say something and you would look at him and go, wow. Like, okay, this guy's off his rocker. But then at the same time, he talked to us. I remember Eric Dover said to him something about using a wireless guitar unit. Mm-hmm. And Eddie goes, "Nah, I don't like using them. They play with my sound." So Eric was sitting there thinking about it. And he goes, "Well, wait a minute. Like, you're playing on these massive stages. There's so much distance from your guitar to the amp. How do you, like, because a quarter inch cable after so many feet, it's just going to lose signal." Mm-hmm. And Eddie goes, "Oh, I developed this thing." And he picked up this little thing that he developed that took the guitar from high impedance to low impedance. And then it would travel 150 feet back to the amp. And then he had another one there that took it from low impedance back to high. So it was like, it was almost like a phone line in between the two boxes. And he goes, "I don't lose any signal at all." And it was like, Howard Hughes moment where we're like, "Oh my God, he just shaved the rivets off the plane. Like, this is insane." Do you know what I mean?
Right.
I watched him change his strings. No tuner. Bam, 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 bam. And I was like, "There's no way you're in tune. No way." And he's like, "Nah, you want to bet me?" And sure shit, walked up to his tuner, and it was perfect. B flat, A flat, D flat, G flat. We're like, "Are you shitting me right now?" Whatever. No tuner, just put the strings on, tuned it by ear, stretched them out, retuned it again, and walked and played his guitar flawlessly.
Was he constantly in his guitar shop, just kind of working on small improvements, like you say, shaving the rivets, like different ways of looking at his guitar? Was he still that obsessed with it, even in those later years?
So here's another thing. So he took us up to 5150, which was obviously on his property at his house. And I would easily say in front of his studio, there was a driveway with probably $500,000 to $1 million worth of cars just sitting there with flat tires, dirty, covered in leaves. Like, and we're looking at him. Like, these cars are just, oh my God, dude, are you kidding? That's a Mercedes, like, you know, with the gold doors, you know, oh my God, like that car's worth like 200K, you know what I mean? And it looks like it hadn't moved in 10 years. You know, Ferraris and all this stuff. And then we go in the studio and he started playing us some tapes. This was when Wolfgang was just starting with the band. And he was playing us some tapes of Wolfgang running through the music with him and singing the backing vocals. And we were all like, holy shit, dude. Apple doesn't fall far from the tree. So we're looking around the studio and we're like, where's your Pro Tools rig? I don't use Pro Tools. I use analog. Everything's on tape. Sounds better. Okay. Then Dover found this room off the side of his control room, had a curtain. And he opened it up and he looked and there was all this tape. And so he turned to Eddie and he goes, oh, is that, you know, tape storage? And Eddie goes, no, he goes, no, it's not tape storage. That's where I file my tapes when I'm done using them. So you can get like three or four ideas on a roll of 2-inch tape. So we go in, we're looking at it. Eric and I are looking, and Eddie yells in, the ones with the numbers are full. Like, so all the boxes were marked. And I'm talking about a 20-foot by 20-foot room by 20 foot, probably 15, 20 foot ceiling with those metal shelves all the way around the room. And from the floor to the ceiling, all the way around the room was Ampex tape, 2-inch tape. Every box had numbers on it. Every one of them. And then there was probably on the floor, just laying on their side, probably another 50 to 60 tapes with numbers that he had clearly recorded something on these tapes. And, you know, for all I know, it could have been the same idea 7,000 times, maybe, but I doubt it. And he's like, his day consisted of getting up in the morning, having breakfast, having coffee, and then going up to his studio with a bottle of wine and just locking himself away in that room and just creating shit. And I know if somebody got a hold of those things, Alex and Wolfie and whoever else, they could probably put out Van Halen records for the next 10 years if what we saw was what we think we saw.
Part of the story of that, there was a database where someone, it may not have been Eddie, but one of the assistants maybe, was keeping track of those ideas. And that database or that spreadsheet was lost or it crashed. So there was a record of what was on a bunch of different tapes with those numbers, but that was now lost because of a hard drive crash or something. So that's the story that I've heard, is that all those tapes, they still exist, but no one really knows what he was thinking or what his idea was on them. You'd have to go back and listen to every single one to kind of try to even begin to piece it together.
Yeah. But I still, like, when he said, I mean, the ones that are marked with numbers are full. So I'm thinking, all right, if he did 5 or 6 minute ideas, you can probably get 3 to 4 ideas, maybe 5 if a couple are short. I mean, if you go by, let's say, 3 songs per tape, he had to have had 1,000 to 1,500 songs sitting in that storage area, unreleased. So That's what I mean. Like, he was, to me, Eddie was funny. He was, like, you know, I didn't spend a lot of time with him, so he seemed like a nice guy. I know I've even talked to Gary Cherone about it, and Gary speaks glowingly of him. But he was, you know, he was a complex human being. And to me, I can't put into words what I saw. But I was like, this guy has moments of, okay, he's certifiably nuts. And then turns around and says something that's absolutely genius at the same time. Within two sentences of each other. You know what I mean? You're like, whatever. So I just said he's the Howard Hughes of rock. You know what I mean? He was just like this brilliant, misunderstood individual.
John, I know you've got limited time. I could ask you questions for hours and hours and hours. We didn't even talk about like cardboard vampires. We didn't talk about a lot of the gigs you've been involved in. Your story is absolutely amazing. I do want to let people know, if you enjoyed John's rambling, and let's be honest, who doesn't? He does have his book, not only in word readable format, but also an audio book, which I believe is 12 plus hours. So Horseshoes and Hand Grenades, you could learn more about it at johncarabi.com. I think it's available in all online bookstores as well. But today we're also celebrating the best of album from the Dead Daisies and the next chapter of John's tenure with the band. Looks like there's a lot of tour dates that are happening as well. Go up to thedeaddaisies.com, check out the tour dates. If they're anywhere near you, make sure to check out this band. Also, follow them on social media so you know when they are coming to your town, and pick up a copy of the Dead Daisies Best of Album. It's actually a very beautiful package. I did an unboxing online, and it's full color. There's a poster in it. There's a booklet in it. Lots to look at and read. It's a double vinyl set, and even some songs that haven't been available on vinyl are on this Best of, and that could be had and learned about at thedeaddaisies.com. John, I hope you can come on the show again. There's lots more topics we can get to, but we'll have to wrap this one up for now. But hope to talk to you in the very near future again, man.
Same here, buddy. Thank you.
Oh, man. That was great. And believe me, we've only just scratched the surface. You know, pick up that book, Horseshoes and Hand Grenades. It is absolutely fascinating. The audiobook is incredible. The way John tells the stories, there's so much more there. So we definitely had to have him back on and go through some other parts of his career. Don't forget the Dead Daisies Best of LP is out now. Go grab them. It's a beautiful package. Two splatter vinyl LPs. It's all full color. There's a booklet. There's posters. There's stickers. It's a gatefold. I mean, everything you love in a vinyl package and more. The Best of the Dead Daisies is available at your local record shop, or go online, thedeaddaisies.com, and they will certainly direct you to where you can get a copy today. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. Share them out on Facebook, tweet them out on Twitter, share them on Instagram or Threads, put them in Reddit forums or Facebook groups. That is always appreciated. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.